In the world of online deception, the most dangerous weapon is the human heart. Welcome back to Behind the Scams. I'm your announcer, Miles. In part one of this two-part episode, we explored the calculated courtship, the careful construction of trust that forms the foundation of every romance scam. This week, our hosts Nick and Sue take you deeper. In part two of The Anatomy of a Romance Scam, we cross the critical line from affection to asset seizure. We'll dissect the moment the conversation shifts, when emotional manipulation becomes a weapon for financial devastation, and how a simple request for help can spiral into ruin. Prepare yourself, because this is where the fantasy collapses.
Welcome back to Behind the Scams. I'm Nick.
And I'm Sue. This is part two of our deep dive into the anatomy of a romance scam.
In part one, we spent time breaking down how these scams are built long before money is ever mentioned. The grooming, the emotional manipulation, the way scammers create a believable persona and slowly draw someone into what feels like a real relationship. We talked about love bombing, future faking, and how a shared fantasy is carefully constructed over time.
That foundation matters because nothing we're going to talk about today makes sense unless you understand that emotional setup first.
By the time a scammer asks for money, the victim isn't making a financial decision. They're making an emotional one. They believe they're helping someone they love, someone they believe they have a future with.
And that's why this conversation is so difficult. Money brings shame. It brings embarrassment. Victims ask themselves the same question over and over. How could I have sent the money?
From the outside, it looks illogical. But from the inside, from within that carefully engineered reality the scammer has built, it can feel completely reasonable.
Because it's framed as love, as loyalty, as support, as sacrifice for a shared future.
Exactly. The financial extraction is always the goal, but it cannot happen without first achieving emotional control. That emotional capture is what makes everything else possible.
So today, we're going to walk through how the money phase actually begins, how it escalates, and how it eventually collapses, leaving devastation behind. This is not an easy conversation, but it's a necessary one.
Let's start at the beginning of the end, the first request for money. After weeks, sometimes months of grooming, the scammer has become a constant presence in the victim's life. Good morning messages, good night calls, frequent check-ins, emotional validation throughout the day. The scammer is no longer just someone they talk to. They are emotionally central.
At this point, trust feels absolute.
Now comes monetization, and they never start big.
Right. It's never, I love you, can you send me $50,000?
Exactly. That would destroy the illusion immediately. Instead, it begins with what investigators call a test payment, a small, plausible, low-stakes problem, something temporary, something that feels solvable with a small amount of money. Often, it's something logistical or technical, especially if the scammer claims to be overseas. My laptop died and I need it for work. My bank card was frozen for a security check. I just need a little help for food or transportation until this gets sorted out.
The amounts are intentionally modest, $100, $200, an amount that doesn't feel dangerous, because if a real friend or partner asked you for that kind of help, you probably wouldn't hesitate.
And that's exactly the point. That first yes is everything, because the victim doesn't realize they're being psychologically evaluated. That initial payment tells the scammers something critical. This person is willing to cross a financial boundary. It opens the door.
It opens the floodgates, because once that first payment is made, a powerful psychological principle takes over: commitment and consistency. Once we commit to something, even in a small way, we feel an internal pressure to remain consistent with that commitment. So helping once makes helping again feel normal.
Exactly. The victim now sees themselves as someone who helps, someone who supports their partner, and the scammer reinforces that identity constantly. This isn't accidental. These scams are engineered using well-documented persuasion techniques. The scammer isn't guessing. They're following a playbook that has been refined over years.
Targeting begins before the first message is ever sent. Scammers scan dating platforms and social media looking for indicators of emotional vulnerability. Recent loss is a major one. Widowed, divorced, recently separated. People who talk openly about loneliness or starting over. Profiles that say things like, looking for my soulmate, or tired of being alone. They're searching for emotional need.
They're also looking for empathy, people pleasers, individuals who struggle to say no, people who derive meaning from helping others. These qualities make someone a wonderful partner in a healthy relationship. But in the hands of a scammer, they become exploitable vulnerabilities.
That's what makes this so insidious. They're not targeting weakness, they're targeting humanity.
To help make this concrete, let's walk through a composite case. This is not one specific person. It's a blend of patterns we see over and over again. We'll call her Linda.
Linda is 62, recently widowed. Her husband passed away after a long illness. For years, her life revolved around caregiving, hospitals, and Greece. When it was over, the quiet was overwhelming. Her children live out of state. Her social circle shrank during her husband's illness. Nights were the hardest. She felt invisible, untethered, alone in a way she'd never experienced before. Eventually, she joins an online dating site, not because she's looking to remarry right away, but because she wants conversation, connection, someone to talk to who isn't offering condolences.
That's when she meets Mark. Mark's profile feels safe. He's in his early 60s, widowed as well, an engineer working overseas on a long-term contract. His messages are thoughtful, polite, warm. He doesn't rush, he listens. He asks about her life, her late husband, her kids, her favorite books. He remembers details. He checks in every morning and every night.
For Linda, the attention feels grounding, comforting. She hasn't felt this seen in years. Within weeks, Mark becomes part of her daily routine. She starts to plan her day around when she'll hear from him. She shares things she hasn't told anyone else, her fears, her hopes, her loneliness. He responds with empathy, validation, affection. He tells her she's strong, that she deserves happiness after everything she's been through, that fate brought them together. And slowly, almost imperceptibly, the emotional bond solidifies.
Then, one evening, something changes. Mark tells her he's frustrated. His work laptop crashed. He needs it repaired immediately because of a presentation tied to his contract. His company card isn't working overseas. He's embarrassed to ask. He doesn't demand anything. He asks gently, almost apologetically. Could she help him with $200 just until the issue's resolved?
Linda doesn't hesitate. $200 doesn't feel dangerous. It feels kind, supportive. She sends the money.
Mark is grateful, effusively grateful. He thanks her repeatedly, tells her how much it means to him, how he knew he could count on her.
That praise matters.
A few weeks later, there's another issue. His bank account is temporarily restricted. International security review. Could she help him with groceries for a few days? This time, it's $300.
Again, Linda sends it. And again, she's praised, loved, appreciated.
What Linda doesn't realize is that each payment is shifting her internal boundaries. Helping Mark now feels like part of who she is in the relationship. Over the next few months, the problems grow. A shipment of equipment is delayed. There are fees, unexpected costs. A contract is at risk. Stress builds. Deadlines loom. The requests grow from hundreds to thousands.
Linda hesitates once. Mark senses it immediately. He reassures her, tells her he understands, tells her he hates asking, tells her he wouldn't ask if it weren't important. He reminds her of their future, of plans they've talked about, visiting each other, traveling, finally being together when his contract ends. The hesitation passes.
Then comes the pivot. Mark tells Linda about an investment opportunity, something he's learned through his work, a cryptocurrency platform that's only available to select investors. This is how they secure their future, he says. This is how they stop living month to month and start living the life they deserve. He offers to guide her through it, step by step.
Linda has never invested in cryptocurrency. It sounds intimidating, but Mark explains everything patiently. He walks her through setting up a wallet. He directs her to a platform that looks polished and professional. She starts with $20,000, pulled from savings she and her husband set aside years ago. Within days, the platform shows gains. 20 becomes 30, 30 becomes 40.
Mark is excited. He praises her courage, her trust, her belief in them.
Encouraged, Linda invests more. She withdraws money from a retirement account. She takes a loan. She doesn't tell her children because Mark warned her they wouldn't understand, that they'd try to control her. By the time doubt flickers in her mind, Linda has already invested over $300,000.
Stopping feels impossible. She's not just protecting money, she's protecting her relationship, her future, her sense of having survived grief and found love again.
Then the platform shows a problem, a withdrawal fee, a tax, a delay.
Mark is calm. He reassures her. This is normal, he says. International finance is complicated.
Linda sends more money. Then the requests escalate again.
Mark asks her to receive a transfer, a temporary solution, he explains. His funds are tied up. He just needs her help moving money between accounts.
Linda agrees. Days later, her bank freezes her account. They ask questions she can't answer.
And suddenly, Mark is gone. No replies, no calls, no explanation.
Linda panics. She worries something terrible happened to him. She waits. Days pass, then weeks. She searches his profile. It's gone. The platform disappears. That's when reality crashes in. The money is gone. The relationship was never real. The person she loved never existed.
Linda experiences physical symptoms she doesn't understand. Chest tightness, tremors, nausea. She feels detached from her own body.
She is ashamed. She doesn't tell her children. She doesn't tell her friends. She doesn't report it. And in that silence, another message arrives. Someone claiming to be able to help her recover the funds. And that's where we'll pick up next. The message arrives quietly, not from Mark, but from someone who claims they can help. They say they've been tracking the criminal network responsible for her loss. They say the funds have been identified. They say recovery is possible.
For someone in Linda's position, that hope is powerful. She has just lost her savings, her sense of self, and the person she believed loved her. The idea that this nightmare might be reversible feels like oxygen.
The person presents themselves as an authority. Sometimes it's a government investigator. Sometimes a financial recovery specialist. Sometimes an ethical hacker who claims to specialize in tracing stolen cryptocurrency.
They speak confidently. They use technical language. They reference real agencies, real laws, real processes.
And then comes the catch. There's a fee, a processing fee, a tax, a blockchain release charge, a legal retainer.
The amount is framed as small compared to what she's already lost. If she pays $5,000, they can release the hundreds of thousands they've supposedly recovered.
For someone drowning in regret and desperation, that logic can be overwhelming. The desire to fix the mistake, to reclaim control, to undo the damage, overrides skepticism. Linda pays the fee, and then nothing happens. The message is slow, the explanations become vague, another fee appears, another delay. Eventually, the contact disappears entirely.
Linda has now been victimized twice. This secondary exploitation is brutally common. Recovery scammers specifically target people who have already fallen victim to a romance scam. Sometimes they are connected to the original operation. Sometimes they purchase victim lists from other criminal groups. Sometimes they scrape forums or social media posts where victims share their stories.
They know exactly who to target. They know these victims are emotionally devastated, ashamed, and desperate for a way out.
And this is why it's so important to be absolutely clear. No legitimate law enforcement agency, no government body, no court, and no credible financial institution will ever charge a fee to recover stolen funds. Anyone who asks for money to get your money back is running a scam, full stop.
While victims like Linda are grappling with this collapse, families are often watching from the outside in anguish. Loved ones notice the changes long before the truth comes out. Secrecy, emotional withdrawal, sudden optimism tied to someone they've never met, financial decisions that don't align with past behavior. They ask questions, at first gently, then with increasing concern.
But by this point, the scammer has already poisoned the well. Family members are framed as jealous, as controlling, as people who don't want the victim to be happy. So concern is interpreted as attack. Warnings are dismissed as negativity.
Families are placed in an impossible position. Pushed too hard, and they risk being cut off entirely. Say nothing, and they watch someone they love unravel. Many describe it as watching an addiction unfold, except the substance is a person who doesn't exist.
There is no perfect strategy for families, but experts generally agree on a few principles. Avoid shaming or confrontation. Calling the victim foolish or accusing the scammer directly often backfires because it triggers defensiveness. Ask questions instead of making statements. Can you help me understand how this works? What's the plan for meeting in person? Questions can sometimes create space for doubt without direct conflict.
And most importantly, keep the door open. Let the person know that no matter what happens, you're there. Because when the illusion collapses, support is critical.
For victims who do come forward, the next phase is often bewildering. They contact their bank. They file reports. They reach out to law enforcement. And this is where expectations collide with reality. From an investigative standpoint, these cases are extraordinarily difficult. Not because authorities don't care, but because of how modern transnational crime operates.
A typical romance scam spans multiple countries simultaneously. The victim may be in the United States, the scammer may be operating from a compound in Southeast Asia or West Africa. The stolen photos might belong to someone in Europe. The money may move through a bank in one country, be converted to cryptocurrency in another, and then dispersed across hundreds of digital wallets in seconds.
Jurisdiction becomes a maze. Which country has authority? Which laws apply? Which agency leads the investigation? And then there's speed. Scammers can move money across borders in seconds. For investigators to obtain subpoenas, coordinate with foreign governments, and secure cooperation with international financial institutions can take weeks or months. By the time that process even begins, the money is usually long gone.
And even when authorities know where these operations are located, another obstacle appears: corruption.
Many scam compounds operate in regions where local officials are bribed to look the other way, or where enforcement resources are limited. In some cases, criminal organizations provide economic benefits to local communities, which makes intervention politically and socially complicated. This creates environments where scam operations can function openly with little fear of consequence.
It's important to understand that what victims experience as a deeply personal betrayal is actually the output of a large, organized system. These are not lone scammers improvising messages.
They are structured enterprises. They have recruiters who source workers. They have trainers who teach scripts and manipulation techniques. They have managers who track performance and quotas. They have specialists who move and launder money. In many cases, they even have internal punishment systems for those who fail to meet targets.
And here's where the story becomes even darker. Many of the people doing the grooming, the ones sending the good morning messages and saying, "I love you," are not there willingly.
There is a well-documented link between romance scam operations and human trafficking. Thousands of people are lured from other countries with promises of legitimate work. They're told they'll be doing customer service, tech support, or marketing. When they arrive, their passports are confiscated. They're told they owe money for travel. They're confined to compounds, and they're forced to scam under threat of violence. If they don't meet financial targets, they're punished, beaten, starved, in some cases, electrocuted. This is modern slavery.
So when we talk about romance scams, we are often talking about victims on both ends of the line. The person sending the money, and in some cases, the person typing the messages, are both trapped by the same criminal organization. That does not excuse the harm being done, but it does explain why these operations are so resilient and so difficult to dismantle.
It also underscores why prevention matters more than recovery. Because once money is sent, especially through wire transfers or cryptocurrency, the chances of getting it back are extremely low. Not zero, but low. That reality is painful to hear, especially for victims who want justice, who want accountability, who want their lives restored.
Which is why reporting still matters. Even when recovery is unlikely, reporting provides data. And data is how patterns are identified. It's how networks are mapped. It's how resources are allocated. Every report filed helps law enforcement understand how these scams operate, where they're concentrated, and how they're evolving. Your report might not get your money back, but it could help prevent the next victim.
And the stakes are rising, because as sophisticated as these scams already are, they're evolving rapidly. Artificial intelligence is accelerating nearly every stage of the scam lifecycle. Language models can now generate emotionally responsive, grammatically flawless conversations at scale. Scammers can manage hundreds of victims simultaneously without fatigue or mistakes.
AI translation removes language barriers. Cultural references can be tailored. Responses can be optimized for emotional impact. And deepfake technology is closing the gap between digital and physical presence.
In the near future, scams won't just feel real, they will look real, sound real, respond in real time. They will remember details, reference shared experiences, appear on video without hesitation. That means many of the warning signs people once relied on, poor grammar, refusal to video chat, inconsistent stories, will no longer be reliable indicators.
Which can feel terrifying, but there is one red flag technology cannot remove. A legitimate online relationship will never ask you for money. Not for emergencies, not for investments, not to move funds, not to pay fees. That request is the line.
No matter how convincing the relationship feels, no matter how real the interaction seems, no matter how emotionally invested you are, crossing that line is what turns a relationship into a transaction. And understanding that distinction is one of the most powerful tools we have for prevention.
It's also important to address something many victims struggle with after the fact: self-blame. Surviving a romance scam does not mean you are gullible. It does not mean you are unintelligent. It does not mean you are weak. It means you were targeted.
You were subjected to a prolonged psychological operation designed to exploit fundamental human needs: connection, trust, hope, and empathy. Those are not flaws, they are human traits. The shame belongs entirely to the criminals who weaponize them.
If you are listening to this and recognizing yourself or someone you love, know this: you are not alone. Millions of people have experienced this. Many in silence, many behind closed doors, many believing they were the only ones. Breaking that silence is one of the most important steps toward healing. Talk to someone you trust. Report what happened. Seek support.
Isolation is part of the scam's design. Connection is part of recovery.
For families and friends supporting someone through this, patience matters. Compassion matters. Presence matters. You may not be able to stop the scam in progress, but you can be there when it ends.
As we wrap up this conversation, there are a few truths we want to leave you with.
First, romance scams are not about love. They are not about foolishness. They are industrial-scale fraud operations designed to exploit emotion. Second, victims are not to blame. The manipulation is deliberate, systematic, and sophisticated. Third, prevention is our strongest defense. Understanding how these scams work is how we protect ourselves and each other. And finally, if you or someone you know has been affected, help exists. Resources exist. You do not have to carry this alone.
Thank you for joining us for this two-part episode of Behind the Scams. We know this was heavy. We know it was difficult. But shining light on these schemes is how we take away their power.
Stay safe, stay connected, and join us next time as we continue pulling back the curtain on the scams that impact lives every day.
The request for money is the turning point. The moment an intimate connection is weaponized and a relationship becomes a transaction. As Nick and Sue revealed today, this pivot is subtle, masterfully executed, and devastatingly effective. It's a calculated descent from feigned crisis to financial ruin. But understanding these tactics is the first step toward dismantling their power. Remember, if you or someone you know has been targeted, you are not to blame, and you are certainly not alone. For more information, visit stampoutscams.org. And for more exciting podcast episodes that pull back the curtain on deception, find us at behindthescams.org. I'm Miles, and thanks for listening.